Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell and I'm here with Leah Kaminsky to talk about her new book, We're All Gonna Die. Don't tune out just yet because although it is true, we're all gonna die, a book about death do not have to be morbid, as Leah has proved herself. Leah, welcome to Booktopia.
Thank you. Hi, John.
Now, we're all gonna die. It's a very bold statement. I like the little stamp on the front, which also says a joyful book about death. How does one write a joyful book about death?
Yeah, it was a real surprise because I kind of, you know, one of those moments in the shower, as you do, where you get this idea of writing a book. It was about 5 years ago, and I have to fess up, I'm a GP, family physician, and I've worked for years and years in the industry and working at the coalface of death and life. And suddenly in the shower, I had this realization that I'm terrified of dying and death. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. I'm a doctor. I'm like, this is my gig. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got the idea for writing a book, and I write to find out what I want to write. That's sort of my thing. So I got the idea of writing this book about 5 years ago of exploring my fear of death, which I think, you know, I share with a lot of people in the world, and put together this proposal with my agent who loved the idea. And this was before things like death cafes and death salons. That was just all starting, and Atul Gawande had just got the contract for his book Being Mortal. And I thought, I really want to kind of go into the belly of the beast and figure out personally why I'm terrified of death. Mm. So I started, I don't know, I kind of went on this death road trip, if you like. I kind of, I went, and first of all, I had so many patients that I dealt with through the years who I looked back at and realised they'd been so, I hate to use the word inspirational, because it sounds like inspiration porn, but really had kind of shifted me deeply and touched me deeply by confronting their own mortality and really having it make their lives very different and deeper in many ways. Not that you need to do.
Did you see any difference between, say, people of different faiths or their own personal beliefs or what jobs they did? Were there different approaches to death, or was it what they've read? You know, what was it that marked people out? Was it completely random? Some people who had faith reacted in this way, and this is a positive. People who didn't have faith reacted in this way, and was a positive. You know, was it like that, where it was random, or did you get to see that certain beliefs helped?
I think it was a very, you know, individual thing, and I didn't see any trending in, and obviously I got a small sample.
Yeah.
But, you know, I interviewed Ariel Manx, who holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the number of backflips you can do while swallowing a sword and standing on broken glass. This guy's amazing. But his whole attitude to life, and he's been through a lot of crap in his life, was just really, it was kind of fun. And so I went out to kind of look at death, and I was the kind of woman that, you know, when my kids came home with skull earrings, I'd go, ah! I couldn't kind of look at stuff like that. And yet, you know, I got this gig at the Morbid Anatomy Museum in Brooklyn, where I got to be the writer in residence and, you know, got my middle-aged inner goth girl on. And it was weird. It was, you know, taxidermy lessons and people going on, you know, couples going on romantic death tour dates. And it's a weird and wonderful place. So I was doing all this strange sort of stuff and following, really organically kind of following where my nose led. And it ended up being surprisingly a lot of fun. Talking to morticians, talking to kids that were terminally ill. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of focus nowadays, and I don't mean to undermine it or belittle it. There's a lot of focus on end-of-life issues in the elderly, euthanasia. They're critical issues to talk about, but I guess my take in this book is that we're not really ready as a collective in Western society to really have that discussion if we're going to sanitize and deny and not talk about death as a whole throughout the life cycle, mm-hmm. from in utero to, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess I was trying to look at different experiences throughout the life cycle. So I've talked to women who've had miscarriages and stillbirths, women who are terrified of getting pregnant, who've got a morbid phobia, tocophobia of childbirth. I've gone in, you know, to my local cemetery that I never would have set foot in before and met the grave digger there, whose name was, true story, Ash. You know, just done stuff I had been terrified of doing before. And people say to me, has it changed you? Are you less scared of death? I don't think I'm less scared of, well, I'm not less scared of dying, because really none of us want to die badly. But I think I'm much more comfortable asking the questions and discussing it. And I'm a person that doesn't have answers. Mm. And I feel like too many of us are looking for answers instead of knowing which right questions to ask. I don't mean to sound cliche in that, but I think what I'm trying to do in We're All Gonna Die is generate public discussion around death and make people comfortable talking about death.
Mm. Well, there seems to be changing. Just in my lifetime, I felt there's a changing reaction to it. Things like the beside the road, the flowers beside the road, these kinds of things. And to my mind, it seems to be going backwards and making a mystery, more of a mystery out of death than is quite necessary, because it really isn't that mysterious. Statement on the front of the cover, yeah, it's everywhere, it's always happening, it's always going to happen.
Yeah, I lucked out and I got the beautiful Mary Roach, who wrote Stiff, which is a book I love, and she wrote the blurb for it. And she said, a beautiful, brave, inspiring work, required reading for anyone who plans to die. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. So there's a sense that things aren't changing. I've read that there are
changing for the better or the worse.
I think it's for the worse. I don't think it's for the better. I think that there's when you don't know, you kind of create myth about things, and that myth sometimes obscures the facts. And the reverence for the dead, the resurgence of Gallipoli and all that, Anzac Day and those sort of things, which when you know in the 70s and the early 80s, it was. They were trying to move away from that. A lot of the diggers were saying, I don't want that kind of thing. That's not that sort of ignores the actual horrors and realities of what we experience. And you're making a myth out of
trivializing kind of in a way.
Yeah. And it would get in the way of staring straight at it. You know, I'm one of the people that I can't watch a TV show which has a live operation on it.
You can't.
No, I can't. So I watch that and I almost pass out. But I can watch, you know, that crazy German guy that did the autopsies.
Yeah, what was that called? I can't remember the name.
It was on late at night, and he would do an autopsy on a dead body. I watched that.
Bones.
Yeah, not on top of the world. You know, he's opening up these dead bodies and showing what cancer does to the body. And I'm very, very much okay with those kinds of. But I think there must be something that reacts physically with me that I have empathy for the person who has been. You know, cut open or having a bone reset on TV or something like that. I feel it too strongly to
cope with.
But the idea of death is not, for me, something that really worries me too much. I've spent most of my friends are dead, and all my great writers that I read, I'm consistently reminded that these people just stop. And you know, when you fall in love with someone like Jane Austen many, many years after her death, you know, you come to grips with that, that is a very realistic.
But I think that's really interesting what you're saying, because I think literature and books really keep us in touch with the dead, because they live on through that. And I think modern society very much focuses on the now or on the future, and I think we've lost our dead.
Mm.
And in losing our dead, we lose the stories and we lose the connection. And I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up by reading. You know, we kind of talk to Shakespeare, I guess.
Yeah.
We're with him. And that, yeah, that I wish I would have written a chapter on that. That's a great idea.
Well, we'll put it volume two.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. But it must be interesting now that you're talking to people who are in the profession of death, about death.
Mm.
I mean, what does a grave digger think of death? Like, what did Ash say?
Yeah, Ash was awesome. And he said he feels safer inside, you know, he feels safer amongst the dead than he does amongst the living. They can't do me no harm.
Right.
So he was really quite a philosopher. I really liked him. And he's grown up in cemeteries as a child too. So this is my kind of happy place. And I walked around, this is a cemetery, literally around the corner from my house, and I walked around and suddenly I discovered all these, you know, Sir John Monash is buried there and a lot of famous artists. It's quite an interesting cemetery, and it was really humbling, you know, walking past these little baby graves and thinking how privileged we are nowadays and how, you know, we're living longer, healthier lives and we've forgotten about what it was not that long ago.
Well, yeah, when you look at the past and death being in front of people more often, you wouldn't get to my age without seeing a dead body. That wasn't going to happen. But now you can get to my age without having seen a dead body live. And people don't deal with death. It's put away. I mean, the wonderful My Struggle, the Carl Ove book, he opens up with his first relationship with death.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really smacks him around. These are things that we don't.
It's a big bullshit cutting factor, let's face it.
Yeah, it is. And you really need to look at yourself and what you're thinking about. And people don't do that. And you can go for so long without actually. And so you can build up a sort of mythology within yourself about what death is going to do for you. You can almost build up a greater fear of it from having pushed it to the back of your mind so often.
Absolutely, and I think that's what I'm trying to get at, why I've called it a joyful book of death, because what I've personally found is since I've started actually confronting my own fear, it's made me think more about my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm on a panel at the Sydney Writers' Festival that's titled How to Die Well, and I kind of feel like I just want to put / How to Live Well, because if you know how to die well, whatever that means, and you talk about death and dying, well, it inevitably frames how you're going to live your life, because we don't know when our number's up, you know. Bloody well decide what you want to do on this planet now.
Yeah. So that recognition that it is for all of us, that death is for all of us, that we need to recognise that. And
I think the conversation's got a ripple effect. I think, you know, we're talking about individuals and society talking about death, but I think there's a ripple effect, and this is, you know, a big leap, but I think it kind of touches into our attitude to the planet too, because if we're not going to talk about death in our own lives, we find it very, very difficult to talk about the potential death of our planet, and I think there's somewhere where we can seek into that denialism that we're seeing now.
Also, if you do examine death, you're then forced to come back the other way and look for meaning in it.
This is great.
And that really is really key, because we create meaning. If we just accept someone else's meaning, we're not really fully living. You need to find out your own reason for life, your own meaning of life.
Yeah, and whether that's personal, within, you know, the framework of religion or, you know, existential, whatever, I think it's an individual work of art. Your life is a work of art and you need to create it. And
do you think it's better to have prepared yourself we all sort of face our parents. If we're living in suburbia and everything works the way it's meant to work and we're healthy and we're sort of, you'll reach a point where your parents will die before you do. You know, it's a lot of people, actually their first time of dealing with this subject is that moment when one of their parents dies. Is it something to talk with your parents about? Like, they're kind of tough discussions to have. You know,
they're very difficult discussions to have, and people often don't want to have them. You know, I know when I, you know, even joke sometimes at home, you know, we can have this when I'm dead. They go, don't talk like that. But I think they're essential discussions to have. But they don't come out of nowhere. They have to, I think there has to be a groundswell. It's a bit like, I think this is the last taboo. I think, you know, the baby boomers are not going to die quietly. We've gone through a sexual revolution. And I think this is a kind of revolution that's starting to, in that we really need to, let's talk about death. So that you don't have to wait for the last minute, you know, on your deathbed to be able to open up that discussion.
And do you think that
it's a more organic and natural?
And you think if that was happening, then it would be easier for governments to make decisions about euthanasia and all these different things, because at the moment, because of the silence, there are people out there talking, but it's not the majority of people out there talking.
It's such a complex issue, and I don't pretend to have any expertise in it. You know, I'm a barefoot on the ground GP.
But none of us can have an expert position if there isn't a general discussion.
Yeah, and I think really it's a groundswell, like we saw with the sexual revolution. It, you know, it grows and it draws more people into the discussion, and I think it has to be public discussions that, you know, come from the ground up. And, you know, people like Andrew Denton are really pushing it. But my question is, I guess, are we ready to have it in, you know, it's the tip of the iceberg as far as I'm concerned. I need to, as a doctor, and my profession's as guilty as anybody of this, that, you know, for years I could feel emotionally inside that, you know, the minute I have to break bad news, we call it, you know, BBN. I could kind of feel almost like there's this camera strapped on my head and I'm zooming out. I kind of withdraw. It's a really difficult, gut-wrenching discussion to have with patients. And we were never prepared for it as trainees or as junior doctors or anything. I think that's shifting. But I think it's got to be across the board. I don't know how that happens. I don't know. I'm not, you know, an expert in politics either, but I'm just, this is my kind of little shout at the top of the mountain, you know, the cat in the hat, like, ah!
Well, I went to university for a while and did English, and one of my fellow mature age students was a doctor who had decided to do a bit of English.
Okay, great.
And he said, you know, it's very difficult for me. I have a stainless steel brain. You put information in, it comes out exactly as you put it in. And here they are asking me to take information which isn't organised, and to regurgitate it in a way that isn't exactly as it went in. And my whole training is that it's meant to come out. And he found it extraordinary, the experience of facing literature and having to have those kinds of thoughts and to break down that part of his brain.
I call it, in this book, I call that, I've got a little term called tunnel vision of the soul.
Yeah.
In that I think my profession, and I've certainly been guilty of it, really kind of looks ahead and doesn't see the nuances in your peripheral vision. And, you know, you look at the sickness but not at the sick. And you don't see the individual. You don't listen to the narrative. You're just so diagnosis focused. And I think that's perilous. And that's why I'm a big kind of, you know, bang my drum of medical humanities. And I think, you know, what your friend had open to him, what literature can teach us and reading is really empathy.
Yeah.
And what better for a doctor? I mean, I think what's taught me more about being a doctor is being a writer.
Yeah.
Because I listen. I have to develop my listening skills, whether I'm on the train or reading a book or whatever. And I would hope that I can then bring that into the consulting room. I think that's crucial.
I was going to ask you about the writing process, because putting down, having these thoughts and putting them down makes you examine them. And it takes a long time to write, and it takes a lot of organisation in the brain to get it to be the way you want it and have the kind of message that you felt is within you at that time. But in doing so, you are examining and you are re-examining these ideas that you may have taken from the interview you had, you may have taken from your experience. And it is hours and hours of thought about a particular point. Mm-hmm. And they can put it. Has that changed, you know, in the actual process from all the experiences you had, then coming down and putting it all together? Did that change how you felt about it? Did you come up with a different book than the one you actually sat down to write because of that experience. Because I've had people who sat down to write memoirs and it's completely different to the way they thought it was going to be.
That's really interesting because, you know, I've written a novel recently and that was a very organic, fluid process where I, you know, it was a bit like Doctor O says, you've got the headlights on and in the dark, you're driving, you can see ahead of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. So I'm not a planner and I don't have a very organized brain. Writing this book, which is, you know, I guess I'd love it to be termed literary nonfiction, I guess, was a different process. And I kind of had the idea of what the kind of framework of what I was going to write about. The big surprise to me was as I was writing and researching and reading and, you know, figuring it out, a lot of me came into the book with a huge resistance, but it was there. And my editors were fantastic at HarperCollins. They said, go with it.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, there's my patients who are really the linchpins of this book. Each chapter kind of focuses on two or three really extraordinary patients that shared their lives and stories with me, and some disguised necessarily, but who I was in the face of that, what did they teach me as a doctor and as a human being, and how has that helped me reframe my way of thinking? Not that I've become a perfect person or a perfect doctor for that matter, but I think that was the surprise in this book, that it was really a very personal journey. I set out to kind of write about death in a more, I guess, journalistic kind of way, but it became a much more personal experience
and a great one. Yeah, I think that's a very good approach, because when you we need our Virgil to take our hand and lead us down into this, and you're our Virgil in this case.
Thank you for that.
Because we can't just go into this subject alone. If we've got you as our guide, and there's more of you, and we can sort of share as our buddy who was.
Well, it's a chain reaction. You know, that's a really kind statement. I hope that that's, you know, what I can be for people. But you know, if you look at me as the guide, I'm holding someone else's hand, and a lot of them are kind of like a chain of patients that have gone before me, and all the reading I've done, and people that have, you know, written before me. Atul Gawande's written some stunning work on death and dying. Oliver Sacks.
Yeah.
You know, I put these guys together in an anthology many years ago, these doctor writers, to take them on a ward round together to see if there was something they were bringing to the page that we weren't seeing in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do, Jerome Grootman said that when the doctor lowers the mask and turns from the clinic to the page, they're checking their own emotional temperature. And I think that's what's so critical in my profession. Banging on about it, but yeah.
Yeah. thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us. This is a subject where I think we need to discuss more, and this is a great way to open the discussion. And it's a very comforting way of going into it, especially with your joyful book about death on the front. So we need a reminder of that, because it is important to discuss this, but not to think of it in too morbidly. And it is, as you said, you look towards death and then you start focusing on your own life and what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for coming to Booktopia.
Thank you, John.
And Leah's book, We're All Going to Die, is available from booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.